thought it might be relevant to start off with a personal story. And this is a story that only a few people that know me have ever told. But it was something where I had kind of a wake-up call about life and about the meaning of life, the importance of life, the fragility of life. And it'll relate to what we're going to be talking about today. And so here's the story. I'll tell you the story and then we'll extrapolate from there. So the story is, and this really happened to me, every detail. I was probably in my early 20s. And at the time I'd been working night shift, working graveyards, running internet cable through government buildings in Ottawa. And I had a night off, so my whole schedule, even the weekend, I had to keep that same schedule. I worked from like 7 p.m. till 5 or 6 in the morning. And so I've got the night off, I've got the following day off, and I'm thinking, hey, I'm gonna get up and join the day walkers for a change and go out and do something. And so I figured a few of my buddies and I would probably go see a matinee at the theater and then go to a pool hall or do something, whatever. And so I'm walking close to the theater to find out what time the movies play, because back then you didn't have iPhones with all the apps that tell you when the next films are coming up or whatever. And it's probably around 12:30 at night, or 12:30 a.m. And I probably shouldn't have been out walking around, but I was, and I went across the street to just grab a can of Pepsi. I don't drink Pepsi anymore, but back then I did. And I go in the gas station to get the Pepsi. I'm on my way. I'm walking past the theater. I'm taking a look at the sign, seeing the times. And I see a group of guys walking towards me. And I'm like, these guys don't look super friendly, but I don't want to judge. I don't want to make an assumption now. So I'll give them the benefit of the doubt. They're walking towards me. I'm going in this direction. This is the way that I have to go to get back to my house, the place I was staying. So I'm just going to keep walking. There's enough cars going by. There was the big parking lot in the theater. And as we're walking by, they walk up and they look at me and they're like, hey man, you got a cigarette? Quit bum a smoke. I'm like, sorry, I don't smoke, guys. Have a good night. That's that. I keep walking. And I'm walking towards an area where there's a split in two. There's like two fences that meet up. And there's like this little gap between the two fences that I was used to going through, because it just saved a lot of time for me walking all the way around all the houses to get to where I needed to go. And so I'm going in that direction, and all of a sudden I hear footprints on the pavement running full speed behind me. I hear someone running up behind me, and I'm sitting there and it all just crashes, and I'm like, oh shit, here we go. I get spun around and all I see is a big giant fist with something gleaming from it. I didn't know what it was right away, but it turned out to be brass knuckles coming right at my head. And then bang, I get hit, boom, right across the face. Head starts ringing, blood from the shot, because it cut me right open, goes shooting right into my eye. I'm blinded. I got blood in my eye. I'm sitting there, just everything's happening so fast. I'm kind of describing it to you in slow motion. And it's this gang, it's this group of six guys. And they start coming at me, and I'm like, holy shit. And my instincts just kick in. You know, I'd been training, you know, I wasn't as proficient in my martial art training then as I am now, but I knew what I was doing. And so I instantly just put my hands up. I just put them up to defend myself, because it's just what you do when you get hit. And the guy's like, I just remember him saying, oh, you want to fight? You want to do some of that karate shit with me, man? And I just kind of stopped. I put my hands out and I said, listen, if you guys want to fight, I will fight you one at a time. I will stay here all night if I have to. But don't be a bunch of cowards and come jump in my ass. And as I'm talking, they're dispersing and starting to surround me. Like, these guys know what they're doing. They probably do this every weekend. This is how they get their kicks, right? And I knew there was a lot of gangs in the area. I knew there was a lot of jumpings. There was a lot of vandalism. There was a lot of thefts. There was murders. There was, you know, it was kind of a rougher area. It was out in the Bayshore area out in Ottawa. So people that live there know exactly what I'm talking about. And at that time in Ottawa, there was also this phenomenon called swarmings, where people would be jumping people in malls, in parking lots, on public buses, on their way to work, broad daylight, didn't matter. Big gangs of people, 10, 15 people would jump one or two people, clean their pockets, take their stuff, leave them crippled for life. And this went on a lot at the time. And there was a lot of, we had a lot of gangs coming in from Somalia. We had just different groups, and I'm not trying to racially profile anybody, so everybody can relax, but it just so happened to be an issue that Ottawa was having. And this was my experience with it. So back to the story, my bell gets ringed. I get decked. I got blood in my eye. I'm trying to focus. I gave the warning. I don't even know how I had my wits about me to say that, because I was still kind of stumbling from that first shot. It took me completely off guard. And as they start spreading out, I realize this is going to get serious really, really quick. And there's that moment where you go through that fight or flight response, right? Your nervous system kicks up. All the blood rushes from the center of your body out to your limbs. You start feeling butterflies. Your knees turn to water. And you're in that moment of truth. You're in that moment of, I'm either going to live or I'm going to die, right? And as soon as I had said to these guys, look, I'll fight you guys one at a time, I just get that little snicker that's like, yeah, whatever. So they surround me. I keep my hands up. And I just start using what in martial arts we call herding. And I'm really glad that I had this training. And I remember only training this once in like a workshop that I did. It wasn't even something we trained regularly. We probably should have. But I still retained it. It was like, okay, the lead dog of this gang, he's the guy talking, he's the guy throwing the first shot, he's the guy instigating it. The rest are followers. They're following suit. They're influenced by the leader. You have to lead that leader, and you have to lead that gang so that they can't get behind you. So you have to move very efficiently, kind of like the way a sheepdog herds sheep, right? That's your goal, is to not get surrounded. Because if you get surrounded, like, I don't care how much martial arts you know, you're in deep shit. And when I put my hands up, that was to them like, oh, you're not just going to sit there and take it? You're not just going to let us kick your ass and take your money? It was an act of defiance in their eyes. And so I hear one guy say to the other guy, hey, let's get the shank or get the screwdriver or something, like, I can't remember what they said, and fuck this guy up. And instantly, it's like your life flashes before your eyes and you're like, okay, this is not just a fight. We're not sparring. I'm not going to walk away from this just with a couple bruises and a couple bumps and scrapes. These guys mean to seriously mess me up or kill me. And that kind of flashes, your life flashes before your eyes in a moment, because you realize I have to get away or I have to fight for my life to survive. I can't sit here and go into some lotus pose and meditate my way out of this. I can't cry for help. I could, but nobody was around. So the first instinct I had was, oh yeah, the gap in the fence. If I can get through the gap in the fence, that'd be the best herding technique ever, because they'd have to follow me through single file and there's no way they'd catch me because I'm a good runner. I'm faster than Tom Cruise. And so I start backing up. And as they're coming in, they start attacking me and I start just pushing them back. And to be just, you know, if you need to clear distance, just pushing people with your feet and your hands and getting space and clearing space, especially when you have multiple attacker scenarios, that's one of the first things you need to start doing. You need to clear space so that you can exit. Okay. Typically in self-defense, if it's one-on-one or maybe two-on-one, you close the gap, you get in tight because you're really safe when you're in tight. But that's when you're dealing with one person. If you're dealing with one person, you can deal very well with the main ranges of being on the outside where they can't hit you, and then getting in on the inside where they can't really hit you, and you have spinal control, and you can obviously go from there. But in this case, I had to clear space. It's just the first thing that went off in my head, and I had to try to lead them. So I start walking backwards in different angles, and I'm trying to lead so that they couldn't all attack me at once, and then so nobody could get behind me. And I'm really glad that even though all that stress was there and I was still kind of wrung from that shot and it was all kind of like hitting me, I'm glad I have my enough training to be able to think like that. Like, my mind went into that mode and I was like, okay, let's go, let's do this. So I clear the space. The guy says, hey, let's get the shank. And then I'm backing up and I'm thinking, go through the gap in the fence. And I'm backing up and I'm backing up and I'm pushing and I'm pushing and I'm kicking and I'm sitting there going, hey, I'm doing pretty good. I'm doing pretty good so far. They're not getting in close. And I could see they were starting to get a little frustrated with me because it just wasn't such an easy, target. And so I back up and I'm thinking, okay, the fence is right there. And I quickly turn and I feel like chain link fence. And I'm like, oh crap. And I look over my shoulder. Guys, I shit you not, the day before I had used this little gap to go through. I do this every day. That day, the day that I got attacked, right there, they put up a chain link fence to patch that gap in the fence. And it all just kind of dawned on me, my escape plan is gone. There's no way out. These guys are going to kill me. You know what I mean? So there was some scuffling. I run around, I change my direction. I'm no longer back against the fence because that'd be even worse. And I'm trying to remember all the bits and pieces. It all happened so quickly. But they're trying to surround me. And I don't know how I calculated this, but I remember seeing only 5 guys all of a sudden. When I remember there was 6 guys. And I don't know how my mind was able to remember that. So I'm thinking, okay, there's only 5 guys. Where's the 6th guy? What happened? They were going to get the knife. What's going on? I see one of the guys in front of me, 1 of the 5, start to crouch down really low, like a wrestler, like he's going to tackle me. And I don't know, it was intuition or something. It was like a voice went off in my head. You've got to clear space behind you. And so I see the guy crouching down. He's starting to come in. I look over my shoulder and I see the 6th guy coming up behind me. And I see something gleaming in the light. There was a couple street lights. Obviously, think of like a theater parking lot, right? On kind of like the outskirts in the back where it's dark, but there's still enough light where you can catch details of things. And you can definitely see anything that's metal gleaming in the light. So I see him pull something else. So I'm like, okay. And I was able to calculate this. Dude in front is going to spear me right into dude in the back, and that's the end. I am a moment away from being seriously messed up or killed. So I remember the guy in front starts to come into me. I was still far enough away from the guy in the back. It's just the way the movement was happening. Guy gets down low. He comes in. I just fire a defensive left hook. I just cleaned right through that guy's chin as he came through. It was one of those shots that you would have practiced forever to time perfectly. Like to have a guy moving in towards you to do like a double leg takedown. And before he gets a hold of your legs, you clip him with a left hook. People practice that stuff and wouldn't be able to land it. In that moment, it just happened for me. I don't know. My body did it. I didn't even think about it. It just, boom. That guy moves off to the side. I fire a back kick. I just kind of like throw a kick at the guy that was behind me. I don't think it hit him. It just kind of like made him stop coming into me for a second. And then I literally dove into the other 4 guys. I just kind of dove like, rah! Because I'm just thinking I'd rather tangle with these 4 nutheads than deal with this guy with a knife. And then it was just chaos from there. And I just remember like covering up. And I remember most of the shots that they threw hit me on the arms. And I was so glad for that boxing, kickboxing training just to be able to protect myself like that. And it was a lot of basically just blocking and pushing. That's really what it was. But anyways, as that's happening, the guy that I clipped starts getting up and he starts moving away because I must have hurt him with that shot. Guy from the back that had jumped back is starting to close in now. Luckily for me, again, there must have been some angels on my shoulder or something. The security guard comes out of the theater and he didn't see what was happening at this point. I just saw him come out of the theater and start to walk around the side where he would have very quickly seen what was going on. The dude that was behind me with the knife instantly kind of like stops and kind of puts the knife behind his back to hide it because I think he's thinking he's been seen by the security. The other guys start to disperse. They pick up their buddy that I decked and they start clearing off. And everything starts to slow down for me at that point. All that panic had happened. I thought for a moment that that was going to be the end and I was going to be some story in the newspaper the next morning. But here I am standing there. Worst that happened was I had some bruises on my arms from blocking shots from these thugs. And I had that massive shot to the face that at that point had started to swole out like that because I got nailed with brass knuckles. Cut me right open. I still have a scar to this day. I don't know if you can see it, but it's there. And I lost my shit. I saw red. I literally felt like I was looking through rose-colored glasses, but not like where everything's nice and dandy, but like you see red, you see blood, you see kill, you see like, oh, okay, fear, like just anger that I hadn't felt in a long time came into me. And it was like an Incredible Hulk moment where I was just like, rah, you want my blood? I started screaming at these guys. And that combined with that security guard, they just start to scatter like cockroaches. And they're climbing over the walls and jumping over the fences and pulling their buddy over. And like, they're all running off. And I start sprinting after them. I remember running after them and like, I'm like, you mother. I was so mad. So mad. Like, how dare you? And so that the security guard, I hear his walkie-talkie start to squawk. I hear him saying something. I hear him running with his big boots that he's wearing. I jump over the fence after these guys like an idiot. And right over the fence, this is the neighborhood now. So like you're going through the garages and everything. And I'm just walking down. I remember walking down the street just yelling like, where are you? Come out here and face me, you cowards. I lost it. And finally, the security guard catches up to me, turns around. I was like, hey, man, what's happening? He went, oh, shit. And he saw my face. He's like, my face must have been swollen out to here. He said, what happened? So I'm like, dude, walk and talk. We start walking. I'm telling him what's going on. He's like, oh, my God. He goes, you know, there's been some issues around this theater. There's gangs have been around here. You're not the first guy. I'm like, well, how about I'm the last guy, right? Let's go find these guys and make this the end of their little escapade. And so he's like, okay, hold on, I'm going to call the cops. So he calls the cops. Luckily, there was a cruiser like right around the corner. There's tons of cops around there because there's tons of violence around there. So the cop pulls up. We got into the car. Cop's like, what happened? So I tell him quickly, we're driving. I'm like, there they are. They're in that basketball court or whatever. We start driving slowly. The cop pulls over. He goes, okay, hold on. We got to catch these guys. He goes, my backup's not going to be here for another 5 minutes or 3 minutes or whatever. So he looks at the security guard. He's like, okay, you're going to go that way. I'm going to go that way. And he looks at me. He's like, you're going to go that way. I was like, oh, all right, I'm down. So we get out of the cop car and we scatter after these guys. And they start running. They catch on that we're after them. They start running. We're chasing them. And the sad story is that these dudes got away. And by the time all the cops got there, they put out some searches or whatever, and these guys were gone. they know the neighborhood really well. They probably went into some garage. But I remember like looking through the, we were running through all the parking garages, looking behind cars and stuff, trying to find these dudes. Couldn't find them. And now my adrenaline's starting to slow down and I'm starting to feel woozy and I'm kind of like, woo. So they made me sit in an ambulance, tell my story, give my testimony, whatever. And one of the paramedics that was there in the back of the truck, he's like, dude, like you're fourth or fifth person this week that we've had to come to this neighborhood and take out of here with these gangs. I was like, what? He goes, yeah, our last victim was a 19-year-old girl. She got jumped by like seven or eight guys. They beat the absolute living tar out of her and stole $20 out of her purse and took her shoes and left her there. And I was like, what the hell? It was like in that moment, I wanted to become Batman. Like I was so angry, guys. I can't even express to you the kind of anger I felt, not just me, but just the sense of injustice, the sense of just that kind of violence. I didn't grow up, well, I did grow up in an area in London, Ontario, where there was some of those kinds of things that went on, but I've always been against that. I've always been so up in arms against that kind of injustice. It's rubbed me the wrong way, and that experience changed my life. And I'm in the back of the ambulance, which I had to pay for later. In the back of the ambulance, they take me to the hospital. I get to the hospital. I've got, you know, they put an ice pack on my head or whatever. I'm waiting for the doctor. I remember just kind of like stalking around. I'm sitting down in the waiting room, and then I'm going into the office where the doctor wanted to take a look at me just to make sure I didn't have a concussion or whatever. And the guy comes in and he's a total jerk. He was grouchy as hell. He probably hasn't slept in whatever. And he was just kind of like trying to go through the motions. And I was so mad. And I was like, the doctor says to me, he goes, well, you shouldn't have been out walking. Should have been in your house where it's safe. I grabbed the little urinal pan they have on the bed. I smashed it off the side of the counter and whipped it onto the floor. I was like, bang, clong. I'm like, how dare you? And I gave this guy the business for like 10 minutes straight. His face was just like, poor guy. And I said, look, I'm sorry, but this, I can't stand to let this happen. And the fact that you can't understand what I just went through, and did you know that there's people have this happen to them all over the place right now? This is becoming an epidemic in this city. The police, I don't know what they're doing, but something's got to be done. And the doc was, at that point, he was kind of cool. He's like, hey man, it's politics, blah, blah, blah. And it's just the way it goes. Sorry it happened. Here, take Tylenol, stay at home, sleep, or whatever. Don't go to sleep tonight. Maybe you have a mild concussion, blah, 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 blah. So end of story. But when I think about it, what changed my life in that moment was that I'd never had my life threatened like that before. I'd been in situations where possibly it was a life and death situation, but that situation, first of all, I was so grateful that I'd been a student of martial arts and at least had the awareness of my surroundings, at least had the ability to calculate in the moment under stress what was happening and make some good decisions, okay, that probably saved my life. I'm grateful as well that there was another person there, like that security guard. I think he also helped save my life, because if he hadn't come out of there, I don't know how that fight would have gone with the other guys that were there and they had a weapon and everything. And aside from the drama of that incident, the reason I'm sharing this story is to really bring it home crystal clear, the fragility of life and the fact that unjust things happen around the world all the time. And if you look at history, injustice has existed amongst all races, cultures, and groups. And everybody that is from a particular background or belief system or religion or political ideology likes to say that their side is the one that is the most pure. It's the one that's going to save the world. And you really just have to understand that whether it's other human beings creating an unjust scenario like that, or whether it's just an act of nature, or whether it's just random events that take place that are tragic. We as human beings have to look at our life as if every day is our last, in a way. You know, not to become pessimistic or anything, not to live our lives in fear of the fact that these things might happen, not to walk around with paranoia like what I walked around with for the next year after that. Paranoia. Like when I went into my dojo the next day, one of my good lifelong friends and senseis, he looked at me and he's like, when I told him the story, he's like, dude, we have to go and kick all of their asses. Like, let's go. And he's like, well, he pulls out all the nunchucks and the asps and all that. He's like, let's go. We'll take care of these guys. And for, I was just kind of like, no, we're not going to keep this cycle going. You know, let's just, you know, it is what it is. And a part of me really wanted to start designing my superhero logo, I'll tell you that, and just start roaming the streets, just cleaning up the garbage. I'm sure many of us have fantasized about that, but there are other ways that we can combat injustice. And one of the ways that I like to do it is through shows like this, where I can maybe talk about philosophy and I can give the information and the concepts that have been shared with me that have helped, I think, make me a better person and help bring out the best in me and help me fight my own inner demons and help me not go down the wrong path in life and help keep me centered and help me become a better father and a better husband and a better friend and a better person in my community. You know what I mean? A better martial artist, a better teacher, a better student. It humbled me and it also showed me the reality a bit. And there's probably people that are listening that have even more intense stories to tell. You know, I feel rather privileged where I live. I feel rather, like in Canada here, we do have I'm in a very peaceful community now, but there is violence that goes on. There's still, no matter where you go in the world, it's there. Okay. And there's scales of magnitude, but, we have committed injustice against each other as human beings since the word human being was uttered. And it's not like one group or one race or one this or one that is guilty of all of it. It is across the board. It is a human thing. And it's like it's like the whole sort of philosophy that was brought out in the Star Wars films of like the light side and the dark side. And both of them can bring you power. But which one are you going to choose? Are you going to choose the ethical road that is better for you and the world around you? Or are you going to take that possibly easier, more emotionally charged route where you're just going to take out your inner turmoil on people around you, which is what this gang was experiencing. These are young kids. These kids are probably 19, 20, you know, and they were raised in a particular environment and conditioned in a particular environment and taught to think a particular way. They weren't shown these principles that I want to share with you in this project that I'm doing with this podcast and the work that I do. They weren't taught the valuable aspects of martial arts. They're not being shown those things, even in the public school systems and the education systems. The media is not really doing the greatest job of communicating that to the youth of today. The role models that exist are not role models for the most part, not to say they don't exist, but they're few and far between. So when you have a broken, sick society, what do you expect from the young people? What do you expect from these groups of people or individuals that are out there committing these acts of violence and terror? What do you expect? Human beings are programmable. We're easily conditioned. It doesn't mean we're not talking about human nature, really. We are, but I'm not trying to bring that in. I mean, I think it's a bit of nature and nurture. I think it's a bit of both, okay? But I do believe in something called free will. I do believe in that. And I'm going to be laying out a case for you in this episode today. We might go a little longer today because I'm going to have to do it justice. And I'm going to lay out why, because I've seen it firsthand and experienced it firsthand where I could have made certain choices, but I did not, because my moral grounding, the way that I made a choice to live my life stopped me from committing acts that I would have regretted later on. I could have gone and hunted every single one of those guys down and went Breaking Bad on them and tortured them in my basement for 3 days and gave them blood transfusions. And, you know, I could have done all that stuff, all right? Or I could have at least gone and brought a gang with me and we could have kicked their friggin' asses and maybe they deserved it. But I didn't do that. because I realized, you know, what's a more effective way of coming out of a situation like that, an experience like that. And I've had a few experiences like that, that have shaped me into who I am now. And I know that I will have more experiences that will continue to shape me in my life. But I know that without some kind of a code of ethics, a philosophy of life, a personal philosophy, like I spoke about on the first episode of this show, which you can go and check out, by the way, it's episode one. Without that, I would have made different choices. Whereas other people, they maybe didn't have access to that. Their parents weren't there. The education system wasn't there. The media wasn't there. The elements in that create a positive, healthy culture were not there. Or they were there and they made a choice not to take advantage of those resources. But either way, yes, those individuals are responsible for their actions. We all are. Self-responsibility is the law. It's one of the natural laws that we all have to understand and accept and live our lives from that place of knowing that we have to take personal responsibility for the actions that we commit and bring into the world. You can do whatever you want. You can do whatever you want. You can think whatever thoughts you want. You can be whatever gender you want. You can be today, right? You can be any sexual orientation you want. You can eat any kind of food you want. You can consume anything you want. Except for certain things that the government deems illegal, which is ridiculous. But anyways, as a human being, you have the choice to do whatever you want as long as it does not affect the free will of other people. Now it's a problem. Now you are now bleeding your crap out into the world and it has ramifications. So if you don't understand the concept of self-responsibility, then you are going to feel like you have carte blanche to go and do whatever you want at other people's expense. And now you're a leech. Now you're a predator. Now you are a problem. And I'm not going to get into the debate about what we should do with criminals. Let's save that for some other time. I'll let you think about it. I have my personal thoughts on it, but I feel like I could be more effective by teaching this beautiful knowledge that comes from the ancient world all the way up to the present that discusses very specifically from, and I'm speaking from the warrior traditions of the world, how to implement the law of justice, how important the law of justice is in society. If we're going to live together and we're going to agree that we're going to work together, and we're going to live together, and we're going to trade together, and we're going to exchange value for value together, well, there has to be fairness. There has to be a law of justice, and it has to be understood, and children need to be educated with that, because there's a law of justice that exists in the universe, and it exists in nature. It is interwoven into nature, into the fabric of nature itself, and you are a product of nature. So if you don't understand this, you're actually living outside of human nature, and that's why we see aberrant behavior. It's one reason. And then the other thing is that we have to understand that we have the free will to choose what path we go down and what decision we make, contrary to what a lot of these materialist atheists out there are trying to preach right now about the fact that there's such a thing as psychological determinism, that your life is determined for you. In the ancient philosophical traditions, this would have been called fatalism, the idea of fate. You can't control the fates are guiding you. You have no free will. Everything's auto predetermined, so just you're just going with all these things that you can't control. And I believe there's a combination of both afoot, and we're going to get into that in a few minutes here. But this is why I want to do this. This is why I feel that this information is valuable, is because no matter what background you come from, no matter what race you come from, no matter what age you are, no matter what sex you are, no matter what you think about anything, you're a human being, right? You can wear your team colors. You can say, I'm a white person, I'm a black person, I'm an Asian person, I'm a this person, I'm gay, I'm a transgender, I'm a la 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 la. But those aren't really what create you as an individual. Those are just superficial, very small branches of the tree that is you. If you want to be an individual and you want to have what you want to call as an identity, your own personal identity, that is something you create. All the whatever spacesuit you're wearing, whatever color it is, and whatever sexual orientation that it has, or whatever biological precursors that it contains, any of that, that's all It should just be obvious that that's the case, and we should move past that argument. Like, for crying out loud, can we move past that argument? Because it's getting really ridiculous, in my opinion. Let's talk about what it is to create a true identity and a true self and a truly empowered, fully realized self. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about what it is to be authentic. Let's talk about what it is to be confident, to have self-esteem. Self-esteem to the point where even if there is segregation in society, even if there is racism or sexism or any of these things, you know who you are, and you know that that's stupid shit, that you don't have to start going around and putting signs up and protesting society and banging everybody's skull off the side of the wall about. If you're confident in who you are, you don't care what other people are saying about you. You don't care. At this stage, agree to disagree. But I'm just saying we've got to move past, we got to grow up, we got to get some maturity going. And I feel like there's some really awesome things from philosophy, from history, from brilliant minds that have come before that are way smarter than me and probably many of us, that have brought gifts to humanity of knowledge and insight and wisdom that we can all benefit from. So I want to go here into some of the different warrior cultures that had a code of ethics, a code of morality. And I want to talk about how important that is a little bit. And then we're going to get into the free will thing. And I'm going to establish a case for free will today. But it's pretty cool. Wherever you go and you look, every warrior culture has a code of ethics, a code of life, a philosophy. Because the warrior class was there to defend justice, right? They were the courageous ones. They were the ones that were there to defend life and defend freedom. That was the role of the warrior. Doesn't mean every warrior culture or group of people that call themselves warriors followed those codes, but those codes existed. And, you know, you always have humans after that that fail when it comes to those kind of codes, and they don't stand up to it. So you can't just paint everybody with a wide brush when they give themselves the title of a warrior class or a warrior culture. It's beyond that. This is the philosophy of warriorship, and it's universal, and it goes back as far as we can track it. Okay, and so I'm going to start with the ancient Germanic code. They have nine concepts here that you have to sort of contemplate that they would have held themselves to as a standard. And this would have been the nine noble virtues of a satru. Hope I'm saying that right. The nine noble virtues represented the distilled wisdom and ancient Germanic moral code gleaned from various ancient sources, including the poetic Edda, the Icelandic sagas, and German folklore. These virtues were kept to enhance the three aspects of being and qualities of the soul. And the three aspects of being in German philosophy were later defined as the Eigenwelt, the Mitwelt, and the Umwelt. The Umwelt, Eigenwelt, and the Mitwelt, meaning like your internal soul, your consciousness, your community, and then the world, right? So there's the three aspects of being. And those virtues, the nine virtues, are courage, truth, honor, fidelity, discipline, hospitality, industriousness, self-reliance, and perseverance. This is very Western. This is a very Western concept here, okay? And I believe that there's incredible value there, and we should really be talking about each of these things. And what maybe down the road I can do some episodes where I bring on some guests or just kind of go through some information for you on each one of these points and why they're important, how they can relate to your life. Because if you want to build a successful life, whether it's just as a human being and pertaining to your individual happiness and success in life, or whether you are wanting to... I'm in an office. If you hear background noises, I can't do anything about that. Whether you're wanting to achieve anything particular, you have a particular goal in mind you want to achieve, whether you're an entrepreneur and you're starting a business, whether you want to do ethical, conscientious business in the world, you don't want to just go out and cut people's throats for money and stomp all over people. You want to actually do some good in the world and business at the same time to enrich your life and others. Well, then there's a code of ethics that you need to follow. Okay, and if you just want to be a good person, you need to have a code of ethics to follow. And you need to believe in them and understand them deeply. And they have to be something that doesn't just enhance your life, but encourages peace and harmony amongst and the upholding of justice in the tribe, in with other people in the world. Okay? So it has to conform to the facts of reality. You can't just make up your own set of rules that just so happen to work out great for you and really horrible for other people, and then go and protest the government about it and, you know, implement it through force. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about something that conforms to the facts of reality, taking human nature into consideration and creating a set of values that you can live by, that you can also expect from other people, where it's an equal exchange between people, so that when you're doing any kind of trade, because that's what we're doing, we're trading conversation, we're trading ideas, we're trading eye contact, we're trading valuable goods, we're trading goods and services, we're trading business, we're trading love, we're trading friendship, we're trading everything. The minute that relationships becomes out of balance, you're operating outside of the law of justice, and that's when resentment happens, fights happen, and it starts to spiral towards violence and decay, right? So these are the pillars that uphold peace and uphold freedom and uphold individual rights and sovereignty, right? Which are all, these are all the topics on the table of discussion when it comes to what's going on politically and socially in the world right now. So courage, truth, honor, fidelity, discipline, hospitality, industriousness, self-reliance, and perseverance. Those are the nine noble virtues of a satru, and they come from the ancient Germanic traditions. Okay? And then when you swing on over to India, ancient India, and you look at the Sikh warrior tradition, it's a very beautiful mystical tradition, actually. A lot of really good things in there. There's a lot of things I don't agree with when it comes to sort of the mainstream Sikh tradition. No offense to anybody, I'm just telling you about my own personal perspective. But their warrior code is fantastic, and there's a lot of really beautiful things in them. In fact, I feel that way about all religions, so don't feel like I'm ever picking on anybody here. I've generated my own personal philosophy. I've gleaned from all the traditions of the world, all the religions that I can get my hand on. I have made it a life study. Because in that moment, when I was telling you that story about getting jumped and almost being killed, it really brought life into perspective for me about how important it is to go ahead and live my life under my terms, to realize life is precious, and to try to uphold the balance. And somebody had told me something interesting about life and death. If you think about it, and it just puts things into perspective for you, if you're starting to get down on yourself or starting to have a pity party and starting to really think less of yourself and think like you're no good, or you're not, you don't have any value to give, and that you're lost, and that you've just had so many horrible things happen to you, and that is just going to forever shape your life, and that you're destined to have all these horrible things happen to you all the time. If you're in that mindset, let me shake it out for you. Let me shake that out of your head. Go look at a tombstone. As grim as that might be, go to your local cemetery and just, you know, walk amongst the stones. Pay your respects to those that have gone before. And take a look at a tombstone. And on the tombstone, you're going to see some writing. You're going to see some carvings and some beautiful designs. And you might look at it and think, well, what's the most important aspect of that stone? Is it the guy's name? His date of birth, his date of death, the fact that he's had loved ones that care for him. And someone told me, he's like, no, you know, the most important carving on those tombstones is actually the dash, the little dash that exists between the date of birth and the date of death. So out of all the beautiful things you could write on there and all the beautiful sayings and how much money you pay for that stone to commemorate the life of that person, the most important thing about that stone was the dash. What was done in the life of that person from the day they were born to the day they passed? And that can bring things into reality for you. What are you doing? What are you doing? Just stop and think, what am I doing right now? Why am I doing what I'm doing? Start to think more philosophically about your life. Don't just do things for the sake of doing them because you've been trained and programmed to do things. I jumped through all the hoops. I went to school. I got my degrees. I'm popular. I got money. I got my car. I got my white picket fence. I got my whatever. It's like in Fight Club, right? You're not your fucking khakis. Who are you? Who are you really? those material things can accent your life and can you can express yourself through certain things. There's the interface with the physical world, of course. But who are you really? And why are you here? And what are you doing? And what do you want to do? And what's that dash going to be for you? Because one day, sorry to say, you're not going to be here anymore. At least in your current form. I don't know if we're not going to get into the reincarnation thing right now. We don't know what happens. And that not knowing is what gives us something so precious, I think. And that's what I feel from when I read the writings of these warriors from the past. They had to wake up every morning not knowing if they were going to die. They had to go out and battle all the time. They didn't know life or death. I don't know. Today might be the end. So I have to live my life in the moment. I have to, every life in every breath, right? I have to be a good person. I have to stand for something. If I'm going to die, I'm going to die for something. And if I'm going to live, I'm going to live for something. And I'm going to focus on that living. That way, when death comes for you, you can look them in the eye and you can smile. No regrets. You lived your life on your terms. You accomplished what you want to accomplish. You could be taken tomorrow and, hey, it would suck, but hey, that's the end. You don't have regret. You followed your code. You followed your path. You achieved great things. You achieved respect amongst respectable people. You achieved the respect of children. They look up to you as a role model. You affected their lives. You made life a little bit better for somebody while you were here. And maybe more than just one person. That dash on that tombstone for you was something that you can always look down upon and be proud of when you're in the afterworld or wherever the hell we end up. So let's go to this code of the warrior from the Sikh tradition. Again, they also have 9. I've read this before in other programs, but I'm going to read it again because it bears true here. It says, a true warrior is humble and gentle. A true warrior has no arrogance and bears no malice even to his enemies. A true warrior recognizes himself as an instrument of the universal spirit. A true warrior will follow and serve the hukam, which is the natural order of the universal spirit. A true warrior seeks justice, freedom, and protection for all beings, recognizing the importance of all creation in nature. A true warrior is ready and determined to stand up for justice, combating injustice in word and in action. In word first. A true warrior is a weapon of the universal spirit. The one who recognizes himself as such realizes all inner self-identity and merges with the flow of nature's law, and hence attains the mental and physical powers of a warrior. So they're talking about how all the mental and physical powers of the warrior come back to connecting to nature's law. And that nature's law is what's being laid out right here. A true warrior fights with his mind before fighting with a sword. And the samurai would say the sword and the mind were one. So that there was the concept of ethics that sword only came out unless there was a reason the sword came out. Right? But you fight with your mind first. Your mind is the sword. It's the sword of truth. A true warrior is a saint and a warrior integrated into one. So you're not just this passive person. I don't want violence. I don't want confrontation. I don't want conflict. You haven't been totally, completely decapitated of your humanity. You know what I mean? You will fight back when it's time to fight. And I felt that urge inside of me that there was a time during that fight that I was in where my life was threatened, that the fight came out of me. That was that seeing red. That was that internal anger. That was that blue flame of anger turned red for a moment because it was so passionate. It was so powerful for me that was the time that I realized my freedom and my right to live and my right to walk the streets unmolested was being attacked against my free will. And so I have every right to defend myself and to do what is necessary, including lethal force if necessary, to defend myself. Because I am not the aggressor. I am not the one starting that confrontation. The choice, the free will choice, was made on behalf of the aggressors to step inside my hula hoop boundaries and pass that barrier, to pass my border. Those people that are for no borders, you don't know what you're talking about, in my opinion. That might rub people the wrong way, but you got to think about this, all right? There is a border between us, and it must be upheld. And there are people who are willing to transgress that border to take what's yours, including your life, if that's what is necessary. There are people that are quite insane and are devoid of humanity, have silenced their humanity, and are willing to do whatever they want. And you can't just blame it all on the system and say, oh, it's because it's poverty and blah, blah, blah. No. In all societies that we have tried, evil has existed in human beings. Actions like this have existed. You can try to create the perfect utopian system, which hasn't existed, and you will still see this happen. The battle of the light and the dark rages on. It always has been. Don't hold your breath for it to stop anytime soon. You need a border of protection. And if you don't believe me, go sleep outside. Go sleep outside. You don't need to shut your doors of your home and lock your doors. You don't need to lock the doors to your car. Just leave everything wide open for people just to come and take whatever they want, whenever they want, including maybe your wife and your kids if they want those, or to take you and sell you on the black market somewhere, you know? Like, just, we don't need borders, right? No. The first border in this principle exists between you and everybody else. There's an agreement. You shall not pass against my will. And if I allow you and I see that you're kind and you have morale, you're moral and you're a good person and you mean well and we're coming together as brothers or sisters, then fine. Welcome. Let's party. Let's have a good time. But if you're not that and I sense that you're not that, you're shunned. Borders up. Engage the shields, Captain, because I don't want to be aggressed upon by some psychopath. Thank you very much. So that's my little rant about borders. Anyways, so this is what I try to teach women in women's self-defense and kids. There's a point where you say, hey, you put your hands up like this and you say, stop. Somebody's trying to attack you and they're encroaching upon your boundary. You tell them to stop. And if they don't listen to you, it's on, like Tron on the break of dawn. All right? Moving on. So those are the 9 from the Sikh tradition. Then we have the virtues of Bushido, of course, which for me ring very true because of the fact that I come from a background in training a lot of Japanese martial arts. And so from that particular warrior culture, this was the code that resonated with me right off the bat, is where I was introduced to these concepts. And then I went and looked around the world and went, whoa, this is pretty universal. But they have 7. 7. There are 7 days in a week. No, 7 codes to live by. Integrity, respect, heroic courage, honor, compassion, honesty and sincerity, duty and loyalty. 7 virtues of Bushido. I don't want to extrapolate them all here. I did a few presentations on this, which you can probably find on my YouTube channel. I don't know if they're still up, but I'll do more in the future for them. But you know, I think we all pretty much understand what this is about, and I'll leave some links below. You can read more. You can do some research on your own time. From the Native American warrior tradition, we have the 7 sacred teachings. This would have been something that was woven throughout their culture through the elders, you know, and the wisdom keepers, etc. But it was the same idea: love, honesty, respect, truth, courage, wisdom, humility, and they even had corresponding animals. So this kind of shows the link to nature, right? The way they observed these animals showed them these concepts. So it kind of shows how, like, as in like the art of Kung Fu, where a lot of the martial art techniques come from animal forms. So you got, my tiger style will defeat your snake style any day of the week, right? That's like the old Kung Fu thing. Well, they learned a lot of patterns of movement from animals, right? So as human beings, we came, we saw the animals did it, and we tried to mimic that. Well, in the native tradition, they did that with a lot of the philosophy. And there are other traditions that did that as well, going all the way back to the Druids, actually. But with love, they use the eagle. Honesty, is it the genu? I don't even know what that animal is. Respect was the buffalo. The truth was a turtle. Courage was a bear. Wisdom was a beaver. Humility was a wolf. And there are many of these kinds of philosophies where their moral code aligns with elements in nature. It might not always be animals. It could be trees. It could be the sun. It could be the stars. There's a lot of astrotheology that can come into this as well. And then I like to bring up the seven Hermetic laws that come out of ancient Egypt and before, you know, from Chem, the Kemetic laws, Kemet. This is talking about how nature works, and that is, you know, mentalism, the principle of mentalism, that all is mind, the universe is mental. It's like it's the universe is conscious, right? Correspondence, the principle of correspondence. So as above, so below, as below, so above, as within, so without, as the universe, so the soul. You see the law of correspondence that's there. You can even see that when you study the concept of the golden mean ratio and the Fibonacci sequence. You can see patterns in nature, and you can see those same patterns reflected throughout your body. And then even your thinking and our consciousness and the way our psychology evolved and developed over time. You know, there's laws of correspondence that can correspond with the natural environment around you, which is why when you walk out into nature and you spend a lot of time in nature, you suddenly feel good and you feel switched on and you feel recharged. There's a reason for that. It's because of the principle of correspondence. The principle of vibration. So nothing rests, everything moves, everything vibrates. I actually brought this up at the end of my class last night when I was teaching some striking, and I was teaching a lot of movement with the feet, a lot of making sure that your feet and your hands are moving together. So you're not just standing on one spot, charging forward like some rock'em sock'em robot, like you're actually moving on your feet and you're moving your body so that it flows properly. So there's no kinks in the hose and you've released all of the resistance in your body. There's no resistance anymore. You're in a state of Zen. And this mimics the principle of vibration, because even thinking about you and the whole personal development of who you are, whatever you're trying to achieve in life, if you're finding that you're hitting roadblocks, if you're finding that you're hitting resistance in your life, in anything you're doing, your task is to remove that resistance in a way. You know what I mean? To find flow again. Because that resistance is like that hose has kinked a little bit, so it's stopping the flow of water, which is this is energy, right? And so if your body isn't aligned correctly, and we play with this concept in martial arts all the time, is that if you're not in alignment, if you don't have structural integrity with the techniques that you're doing, then you're not using the principle of vibration and proper alignment, and you will be easily defeated in those positions and with those techniques because they're not efficient. See, we're always trying to look for the most efficient way to do things, because in martial arts, we're often dealing with a greater odds. So it's defending yourself. You're not going to be attacked by someone that's your size or smaller than you for the most part. You're going to be attacked by somebody that's bigger than you, or in my case, you're going to be outnumbered. They're going to have weapons. Who knows, right? So the concept is that you need to learn how to be as efficient as possible so that you don't burn energy and gas yourself out, so that you don't waste techniques, so that you're missing and exhausting yourself and being ineffective, and so that the techniques that you are working with are effective and can work on anybody regardless of their size and strength. So when you understand the law of vibration, you're realizing that movement is the key. So if your mind gets stuck, move your body. If your body's getting stuck, move your mind. Think about concepts, loosen things up. And when you realize there's a connection between the mind and the body, and that the more you get good flow and good movement from your body, the better your flow and your movement's going to be in your mind. Then the better the flow is going to be in your business, your relationships, your life, your training, your techniques, whatever you're trying to master. You're a dancer, you're a musician, whatever, you'll have better flow because you understand these laws, correspondence, mentalism, vibration, etc. The next one would be the principle of polarity. Everything is dual. Everything has poles. Everything has its pair of opposites. Like and unlike are the same. Opposites are identical in nature, but different in degree. Extremes meet, but all truths are but half-truths, and all paradoxes may be reconciled. So this is the idea that we always know there's polarities. There's good and evil. There's light and dark. There's electricity and magnetism. There's masculine and feminine. There's duality everywhere. It's the yin-yang. And the law of balance is to try to get them working in harmony together, not to change them, not to forcefully change everybody into one thing, which is what's happening in the world with this whole globalization nonsense that's going on and this whole neo-Marxist agenda in our society that is trying to make everybody equal. The fact of the matter is there is a hierarchy that exists in knowledge, in, I'm not the greatest chef in the world. I suck at cooking. I would admit it. My wife would tell you right away. I'm not the greatest person in the kitchen. I stumble around like an idiot in there. Okay. I'm trying to learn, but I will only, for the rest of my life, I will only get so good at that. because I don't have a natural desire or proclivity or talent in that field. But there are areas that I am good at. So in the chef world hierarchy, you wouldn't want me to be the chef at the restaurant that you go and eat at. And if you're coming over to my house, unless I'm making French toast, you don't want me cooking. You want the best chef that's passionate about it, that loves doing it, that has a talent for it, that knows it, that studies it, that practices every single day. They're at a higher level in the chef hierarchy than I'm going to be. So if you create a whole society full of people that are equalized, you get what's happened in the past when dictators like Mao Zedong and Stalin and Hitler and all these people try to make these things happen. You get the opposite, and you don't have the law of polarity at work because you're not recognizing that there is a balance and an order to nature that you can't mess with. And when you try to flatten that out to try to achieve some utopia, it ends up being a living hell. Okay, and I'll post a link to a fantastic video where Dr. Jordan Peterson goes into this. It's 8 minutes long. It'll change your life. Moving on. Gender. The principle of gender. Gender is in everything. Everything has its masculine and feminine principles. Gender manifests on all planes. So moving past this argument of, oh, well, the genders and there's like how many different ways that we have to recognize all these different spectrums of gender. You know, regardless of that, and I'm not against somebody being a specific identity or whatever you want to do, but just remember that whether you're a man or a woman, philosophically, we have a masculine and a feminine principle. We have the yin and the yang in all of us. So we need to move past the physical gender thing. I think we're so materialistic that now the argument has become how I'm perceived by everybody physically. I look like a boy, but actually I want to be a girl. Or I look like a girl, but actually I want to be a boy. The reason we're confused is because we're not understanding these principles. And whatever you want to be physically and whatever gender or sex or sexual orientation you want to have, that's your free choice. Nobody should be infringing upon that. But the infringement shouldn't come the other way as well, where now we have to start tiptoeing around the daisies all the time with everything. Okay? Recognize that gender is something that all of us have both correspondences in when it comes to your consciousness. And when it comes to physicality, let's leave that for another day. I'll let you rest on that. But this is when they're saying the principle of gender and genders and everything, it's talking about a philosophical understanding of masculine principles, right? The blade, upper pointing triangle, and the chalice, feminine, downward pointing triangle, representing, you know, the feminine goddess and all that kind of stuff. So if you want to learn more about those kind of things, you should tune into the Unslaved podcast. You should check out the Path of the Fool series that I did with Michael. He really breaks that stuff down. The principle of rhythm. Everything flows out and in, and everything has its tides. All things rise and fall. The pendulum swing manifests in everything. The measure of the swing to the right is the measure of the swing to the left, and rhythm compensates. So the principle of rhythm. If you're a musician, you know what I'm talking about. If you're a martial artist or a movement, you're in movement culture, you understand what I'm talking about. If you can get some rhythmic action happening, all of a sudden your game just goes up like 25,000%. If you're just stagnant and trying to force yourself through the moves and try to get through and remember all the things, oh my God, I got lost here, you're still a white belt. The best people in the world, they just move easily, effortlessly, and with rhythm. And that's why they're the best. And then the final one is the cause and effect. The principle of cause and effect. Everything, every cause has its effect and every effect has its cause. Everything happens according to law. And the law they're talking about is the law of nature. Everything that happens happens according to law. Chance is but a name for law not recognized. There are many planes of causation, but nothing escapes the law. So there's the principle of cause and effect. In the universe, some things are fixed, some things are mutable. So there are fixed things that we cannot change. The sun's going to rise, the sun's going to set. You're going to be born, you're going to die, and you're going to pay taxes. There are some things you cannot change. But there are also things that you can change. And the things that you can change are based on how you decide to operate in the world. You can control your thoughts. It can be hard. It's challenging. It's an art form. Yes. And maybe there are some elements of your mind you really can't control. But largely, you can control your thinking. You can control your emotional responses when you are at a level of maturity and development where you can actually process your emotions. You're very in touch with your emotions, so you don't just lash out at everybody and go nuts every time someone just says one little thing. Like all these social justice warriors today, you know, just, whoa, what happened? But anyways, you're not just going to flip out from an emotional place only. You are more holistic in the way that you react to things. You can think logically and you can think intuitively. You think mentally, you know, masculine, feminine, right? So there's a cause and effect. The cause to actions in the world is, what's your worldview? So like the actions that were taken against me by that gang that jumped me and tried to kill me, what was their intention? They didn't want to work for theirs. They didn't want to go out and be productive and do something good in the world to get their what they wanted, the money or whatever. They decided they were going to steal. And when you think of all crime, in the end, it's all stealing of some kind. Stealing somebody's life, stealing somebody's property, stealing somebody's privacy, stealing, you know what I mean? So if you think about it, it's all theft. And theft, what's the cause of theft? A lack of moral grounding, a lack of philosophy, a lack of a healthy society, a lack of proper education, etc., right? Cause and effect. So the effect of those people is going to be very toxic in the world. But on the other hand, if the cause is that, you know, you do understand these principles and you do exercise these principles in your life, then the effect in the world is going to be so much greater. And you know what? All the abundance you want is going to come your way. If you're out there seeking abundance and you want to live, maybe you're seeking to become successful in some business. You want to achieve financial freedom and you just want to have a freedom lifestyle and write your own hours and live where you want to live and do what you want to do without being worrying about whether you're going to survive or not all the time. Then you have to follow certain laws and principles and integrate them into your life so that you can go out and achieve that. And the cause will start with you, and then the effect will be the actions you take in the world, and the universe will respond. That's the law of correspondence. Universe will respond. As above, so below. As within, so without. So whatever you're producing internally, you're going to see manifesting externally. Simple as that. So how long are we in here? We're an hour already. Okay, so we're going to keep going here, guys. Hope I'm not boring the shit out of you. I hope this is adding some value to you. And I am going to move on to discussing free will, because I have to, as a philosopher or somebody that thinks about philosophy, I have to establish this. This is very, very important, because if there's no such thing as free will, then I'm just talking out of my ass. And criminals are just always going to be criminals, and people that do good are just always going to be do good, and everything's just going to be what it is, and there's nothing we can do about it. If you're depressed right now, sorry, there's no solution. That's just the way it is. You have no free will to get yourself out of that position. If you're in poverty right now, sorry, you're always going to be in poverty, because you're just never going to be able to learn the new skills to go out and achieve something of value in your life. And if you're doing things that are causing harm to other people, well, it's all genetic. It's all predetermined. There's nothing you can do about it. You don't have free will. You can make choice to an extent, but you know, free will doesn't really exist, because it's all psychological determinism, which is just the most ridiculous thing ever. And I got to say, this discussion on free will, excuse me, has existed for millennia. It's existed as long as philosophy has existed, let me tell you. And I think it all comes down to psychology more than it does philosophy in the end, because I'm sitting there going, all right, my psychology is wired to accept the concept of free will. Another person has not. And it's always been this struggle in philosophy of, do you have free will, or is everything predetermined? Is it fate, or is it, you know, do you create your own fortune? And to me, it came as a surprise that this is still a debate, and there's still authors like, you know, people like Sam Harris and other people that are out there talking about this stuff. And I'm glad that more intellects like Jordan Peterson and, you know, Michael Tsarian and so many other people are coming out and bringing out incredible arguments against that to show the other side. And I'll leave it up to you. I don't want to brainwash you and make you follow my thing or whatever, but I am going to express my opinion. But when I express my opinion, I want you to know that that's my opinion right here and right now, based on the information I have. And your opinion is the same. So we're after truth. And when you're after truth, you got to kind of pull yourself out of the equation for a moment and say, well, what is the actual truth about this discussion? And that's what's beautiful about Western culture specifically, is that here in the West, our sort of tradition is that we actually have debates. We actually have discussion. We actually have arguments about these concepts so that we can get to the truth. The idea is, to pursue truth, you need to have those opposite forces, the duality principle at work, so that you can combat those things like the left and the right in politics. It's supposed to be a voice for the people and a voice for, you know, reason and rationality, right? Those have to kind of, you know, the masculine and the feminine, you know, a little bit more control, a little bit more order versus, let them do what they want. Let's less controls, you know. We're not saying one is better than the other. We're saying there has to be an equal discussion because both sides should have valid points if they're to be valid at all. And we need to be able to strike the law of balance between the two. It's like in your brain, you have this duality happening right now. You have a left hemisphere of your brain and a right hemisphere of your brain. Are you now going to live the rest of your life only thinking with the left, logical, analytical side of your brain all the time? You will spiral into depression before you can snap your fingers if you do that. Or on the other side, are you going to shut that off using all kinds of drugs and things like that to shut off the logical, reasonable part of your brain? You're never going to think for yourself anymore. And now you're going to be wholly in the right brain where you're only this creative, yuppie, hippie out there constantly in the clouds, not grounded at all, not even able to look people in the eyes anymore kind of person. These are the extremely spiritualist, religious type people that end up going insane and developing incredible amounts of psychological disorders because of the fact that their brain has been thrown off balance, right? The trick would be, let me know what you think about this. The solution to this is to use both hemispheres of the brain. There you have it. You use both. You think with your whole brain. You were given a whole brain. Why would you only pick one side? It's beyond me. And speaking of the brain, actually, it was Michael Tessarian that shared this article with me. So thanks, Michael. Word up, bro. This is from aeon.co, and aeon is aeon.co. It's a great website, and they had a fantastic article called The Empty Brain, how your brain is not a computer. A lot of people describe the brain as a computer because we live in the technological age, and so you have these reductionist types, these materialist types, that are trying to promote the idea that this reality is nothing but a supercomputer simulation, and human beings are all just small little circuits within that computer, and your brain is just a computer because you're just a biological machine. You're not, there's no consciousness, there's no spirit, there's just matter. There's just what you see with your five senses, right? So it's just that. Okay, now, we're not saying that doesn't exist and that's not important and science isn't important. It is. There is a reality. There is an objective reality out there. You and I can walk past the same set of trees and we're both going to see them and they're there and they're real. And if you run headfirst into them, man, you're going to have a headache. It's pretty real to us, okay? It's there. But that's not all there is. And the way we perceive that is not what we think in many cases. So the brain is not just some computer. You're not just some computer android that's programmed. The system wants this philosophy to thrive in the world. Don't you see that? And by the system, I mean the system, not the system that is set up for the goodness of humanity, but the system set up by, you know, certain subsections of society to control other sections of society. And the way you do that is you go, hey, you're all just a bunch of androids. Look at you. You're all on your phones. And in a couple years, you're going to have electrodes and nanoparticulate put into your body and into your brain. So if you don't believe your brain is a computer, just wait. We're going to turn it into one for real. And then now you're an android. Now you're the part of the Borg. Now we can program you. Now there's no such thing as privacy. Now we're all equal. Now we have equality. There's no such thing as individuality anymore. There's no philosophy or thinking. There's no reason to try hard at anything anymore because you can just Google that shit. You don't have to think. Will think for you. The computer will think for you. You don't need to worry about life and death and think about life in this intricate balance with the way the order of the universe functions. No, we're going to bypass all that. It's all just going to be a giant supercomputer, virtual reality, that we're going to hand to you on a silver platter. And that's why we're bringing all these political neo-Marxist ideologies into the fray right now. And that's why we're creating a globalist world. Because you're just a bunch of computers and you need to be controlled and you need to be managed and you need to be monitored. Maybe I'm crazy, but that's just what I see. So this article, The Empty Brain, is talking about how that's a bunch of nonsense. Your brain is not a computer. So I'm just going to read a little bit to you. I'll post it, but sit back, grab some popcorn. The article says, no matter how hard they try, brain scientists and cognitive psychologists will never find a copy of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony in the brain, or copies of words, pictures, grammatical rules, or any other kinds of environmental stimuli. The human brain isn't really empty, of course, but it does not contain most of the things people think it does, not even the simple things such as memories. Our shoddy thinking about the brain has deep historical roots, but the invention of computers back in the 1940s got us especially confused. I'm glad they make this point. For more than half a century now, psychologists, linguists, neuroscientists, and other experts on human behavior have been asserting that the human brain works like a computer. To see how vacuous this idea is, consider the brains of babies. Thanks to evolution, human neonates, like the newborns of all the other mammalian species, enter the world prepared to interact with it effectively. A baby's vision is blurry, but it pays special attention to faces and is quickly able to identify its mothers. It prefers the sound of voices to non-speech sounds and can distinguish one basic speech sound from another. We are, without doubt, built to make social connections. A healthy newborn is also equipped with more than a dozen reflexes, ready-made reactions to certain stimuli that are important for its survival. It turns its head in the direction of something that brushes its cheek, and then sucks whatever enters its mouth. It holds its breath when submerged in water automatically. It grasps things placed in its hands so strongly it can nearly support its own weight. Perhaps most important, newborns come equipped with powerful learning mechanisms that allow them to change rapidly so they can interact increasingly effectively with their world, even if that world is unlike the one their distant ancestors faced. Interesting. Senses, reflexes, and learning mechanisms, this is what we start with, and it is quite a lot when you think about it. If we lacked any of these capabilities at birth, we would probably have trouble surviving. But here is what we are not born with. We're not born with information, data, rules, software, knowledge, lexicons, representations, algorithms, programs, models, memories, images, processors, subroutines, encoders, decoders, symbols, or buffers. Design elements that allow digital computers to behave somewhat intelligently. Not only are we not born with such things, but we don't develop them ever. We don't store words or the rules that tell us how to manipulate them. We don't create representations of visual stimuli, store them in a short-term memory buffer, and then transfer the representation into a long-term memory device. We don't retrieve information or images or words from memory registers. Computers do all these things, but organisms do not. Computers quite literally process information, numbers, letters, words, formulas, and images. The information first has to be encoded into a format that computers can use, which means patterns of ones and zeros, or bits, organized into small chunks, bytes. On my computer, each byte contains 64 bits, and a certain pattern of those bits stands for the letter D, another for the letter O, and another for the letter G. Side by side, those three bytes form the word dog. One single image, say the photograph of my cat Henry on my desktop, this is the guy writing this, right, is represented by a very specific pattern of a million of these bytes, 1 megabyte, surrounded by some special characters that tell the computer to expect an image, not a word. Computers quite literally move these patterns from place to place in different physical storage areas etched into electronic components. Sometimes they also copy the patterns, and sometimes they transform them in various ways. Say, when we are correcting errors in a manuscript, or when we are touching up on a photograph. The rules computers follow for moving, copying, and operating on these arrays of data are also stored inside the computer. Together, a set of rules is called a program, or an algorithm, a group of algorithms that work together to help us do something, like buy stocks or find a date online, etc., is called an application, what most people now call an app. Right? There's an app for that. There's an app for everything. So the author says, forgive me for this introduction to computing, but I need to be clear. Computers really do operate on symbolic representations of the world. They really store and retrieve. They really process. They really have physical memories. They really are guided in everything they do without exception by algorithms. Humans, on the other hand, do not, never did, and never will. Given this reality, why do so many scientists talk about our mental life as if we were computers? So, And this is like, guys, this is like a book. Like this, I can't recommend this article enough. And thank you to the author of this article. I'm crediting the crap out of this. So please don't come and give me trouble for including this in my show, because it's fantastic. And I want you to go through and read all the evidences that he lays out for the fact that it's complete nonsense that they're comparing us to computers. And that science is where the materialists are coming from. That is where they're deriving their data, is they're comparing us to computers in the wrong way, because that is not how it works. That's what this article is saying. Okay? And let's continue on. I'm going to dig right in here. We're going to talk about something called epigenetics now. And this will completely debunk any notion of determinism. If you haven't heard of epigenetics, you're living under a rock and you need to hear about them. So I'll introduce them if it's your first time. If not, sit back with a smile on your face and check this out. I have another article here from Chris Dresser. I like his website. Let's Take Back Your Health Starting Now. Awesome. So Chris Dresser, he's just a blogger, and he's talking about why genes aren't your destiny. I'll include this article as well, but let me just read through it a little bit. I really enjoy doing this. At one time, scientists believed our DNA held the keys to preventing and reversing disease, but we now know that our environment, not our genes, is the primary driver of health and longevity. The 20th century was the golden age of genetics. It ushered in the discovery of the double helix structure of DNA, the polymerase chain reaction, the PCR method of amplifying DNA, and ultimately the sequencing of the complete human genome. Somewhat understandably, these remarkable discoveries led to biological determinism, the belief that human behavior and health is mostly, if not entirely, controlled by our genes. And it has generated some pretty bold proclamations, such as, "We now have the possibility of achieving all we've ever hoped for from medicine," which is quoted from Lord Sainsbury and the former UK Minister of Science. "Mapping the human genome has compared with putting a man on the moon, but I believe it is more than that. This is the outstanding achievement not only of our lifetime, but in terms of human history." That comes from Michael Dexter. The author says, "But it quickly became apparent that these heady promises weren't going to pan out. Even Craig Venter, one of the first scientists to sequence the human genome, recognized limitations of using genes to predict and prevent disease. Craig Venter says, "We simply don't have enough genes for this idea of biological determinism to work." It's from the man himself. "We now know that genes account for about 10% of human disease. So if our genes aren't driving disease, what is?" So this goes on into talking about a lot of environmental lifestyle aspects that, the epigenome, talking about those things that are contributing to disease, okay? And we're talking disease, physical and mental disease. But there is one little section here I'll read. It says, "The epigenome, where our genes and episome meet." I don't know how to say that word, but whatever. "The nature versus nurture debate. The question of whether our genes, or nature, or environment, nurture, are more important to determining our health has raged on for decades. But the relatively simple distinction we've made over the years between genes and environment, as if they are separate and unrelated factors, turns out to be inaccurate." According to Dr. Randy Jertle, he says that the nature versus nurture argument is rapidly proving to be irrelevant because we're finding that the two forces interact in highly specific ways that alter gene behavior. And Dr. Jertle is a pioneer in the field of epigenetics. And epigenetics, which literally means on top of genetics, is the study of modifications to our genetic material that change the way genes are switched on or off, but which don't alter the underlying genes themselves. We used to think of our DNA that it was like a template or a mold. If you poured raw genetic material into this mold 100 times, you'd get 100 identical copies. This is consistent with the philosophy of biological determinism. That was in vogue right around the time the human genome was sequenced. But a better analogy for genes might be a script for a theater production or a film. Our genes are rather like a script, and the exposome, it's called the exposome, I'm sure that's how you say it, and the epigenome are like the production and the performance. The script of Romeo and Juliet doesn't change from one production to the next, but how it is processed, how it is produced and performed can vary dramatically depending on the director, cast, crew, set designs, costumes, and other factors. If a script is terrible, even a great performance can't save it. On the other hand, the best script in the world won't matter with a terrible production. This explains why identical twins are similar but not the same. They are matched for genes, age, sex, pre-gestational, and often post-gestational environment, so we'd expect their risk of having the same diseases to be very high if genes were running the show. Yet in most cases, the discordant rates between twins for even highly hereditable diseases like schizophrenia can only be up to about 50%. In other words, if one identical twin has schizophrenia, there's only a 50% chance that the other twin can have it. And Dr. Francis Collins, director of U.S. National Institutes of Health, once summarized the relationship between genetics and the episome in a single sentence. Genes load the gun, but environment pulls the trigger. So they're also going on to say, you know, genes do have an influence. There's precursors, there's genetic precursors, but we're not destined, we're not controlled entirely 100% by our genes in a lot of cases. And epigenetics is, it's a big field that a lot of scientists are now moving towards. It was resisted in the beginning. Kind of first time I heard about it was from Dr. Bruce Lipton when he was talking about the biology of belief. But now so many more scientific studies have been done to showcase that this is the fact. And when you really think about what we're talking about with epigenetics, the ancient sages and philosophers of the past were already talking about these concepts thousands of years ago. They just use different terms and different words. So it's really interesting. And this has a profound impact on the way that you view yourself and the way you view the world and the way you view how much control you have over your life. Because if you don't understand the concept of free will and where you have free will and where you don't have free will, well, then sad to say, you're not really going to be in control of your destiny whatsoever. So now I am going to really get into an argument here for you about free will that is going to explain this argument. It's the best explanation I've come across. It's one of the best arguments I've come across. It's actually something that comes from Nathaniel Brandon. I've spoken about him before. He's famous for his book, The Six Pillars of Self-Esteem. But the man was a genius, and he wrote on many subjects, and he did a lot of talks on philosophy. And he most certainly established this case for free will. And I'm kind of finding it interesting that many people that are proponents of free will or opponents of it don't bring his arguments and his work and his talks on this and his books on this into the discussion, because they're very, very poignant and very, very relevant. So I actually took a transcript, an audio presentation that he did. I don't know if you can get this presentation online anymore, so I'm just going to read it for you here. Sorry, there's a lot of reading in this show, but I just really want to drive this point home. So let's talk about free will and the concept of psychological determinism and how it impacts your life, okay? So sit back, relax, and hopefully I don't lull you off to sleep. Take some notes here. Nathaniel Brandon starts off by saying, psychological determinism denies the existence of freedom or volition in human consciousness. It holds that every desire, action, and thought is determined by forces beyond our control. It holds that in relation to our actions, decisions, values, and conclusions, man is ultimately and essentially passive. That human beings are essentially a reactor to internal and external pressures. Those pressures determine the course of our actions and the content of our convictions, just as physical forces determine the course of every particle of dust in the universe. It holds that in any given situation or moment, only one choice is psychologically possible to us. The inevitable result of all the antecedent forces infringing upon us, just as one action is possible to the speck of dust. So he's basically saying that the concept of psychological determinism holds that we have no say. We're passive when it comes to all the antecedent forces that infringe upon us. Just as if you have a speck of dust floating around in the room, it has no choice as to where it's going to go. That we're no different than a speck of dust, because we're computers, by the way, right? And I will include some definitions, such as the definition to antecedents, in the description if that helps you in your research. Determinism holds that humans have no actual power of choice, no actual freedom or self-responsibility, according to this view, we have no more actual volition than a stone. Man is merely confronted with more complex alternatives and is manipulated by more complex forces. The deterministic concept of mind entails a crucial contradiction, specifically an epistemological contradiction, so philosophical. It is, and can be shown to be upon analysis, a self-refuting or self-invalidating theory. A contradiction in any variety of determinism, and there are many, whether the alleged determining forces be physical, psychological, environmental, or divine, it wouldn't matter if you hold that man is determined by the gods, or by his genes, or by his upbringing, or socioeconomic environment, or background, or position. This contradiction is common to all of them. So all the different ways that you can hold determinism to be true, he's saying, environmental, religious, or otherwise, or scientific, the contradiction we're going to lay out here is common in all of those different variations. So consider the following. The deterministic quality, or the determinist concept of mind, maintains that whether a man thinks or not, whether he takes cognizance of the facts of reality or not, whether he holds facts above his feelings or feelings above the facts or not, all are determined by forces outside of his control. In any given moment or situation, his method of mental functioning is the inevitable product of an endless chain of antecedent forces. He has no choice in the matter. That which a man does declare, the advocates of determinism, he had to. That which he believes, he had to believe. If he focuses his mind, he had to. If he evades the effort of focusing his mind, he had to. If he is guided solely by reason, he had to be. If he is ruled instead by feeling or whim, he had to be. He couldn't help it. No one can help anything. Such is the deterministic thesis. But if this were true, no knowledge would be possible to man, as shall be shown. No theory could claim greater plausibility than any other, including the theory of psychological determinism. Why? It is most essential to understand this issue. First of all, remember that man is neither omniscient nor infallible. This means A, that he must work to achieve his knowledge, and B, that the mere presence of an idea inside his mind does not prove that the idea is true. Many ideas may enter his mind which are false. But if a man believes what he has to believe, if he is not free to test his beliefs against reality and to validate or reject them, if the actions and content of his mind are determined by factors that may or may not have anything to do with reason, logic, and reality, then he can never know if his conclusions are true or false. Knowledge is the correct identification of the facts of reality. And in order for man to know that the contents of his mind is to constitute knowledge. In order for him to know that he has identified the facts of reality correctly, he requires a means of testing his conclusions. The means is the process of reasoning, of testing his conclusions against reality and checking for the contradictions. It is thus that he validates his conclusions, and this validation is possible only if his capacity to judge is free, that is, non-conditional, given a normal brain state. But if his capacity to judge is not free, there is no way for man to discriminate between his beliefs and those of a raving lunatic. But then how do the advocates of determinism acquire their knowledge? What is its validation? Determinists are conspicuously silent on this point. If the advocates of determinism insist that their choice to think and their acceptance of reason is conditional, dependent on factors outside of their control, which means that they are not free to test their beliefs against the facts of reality, then they cannot claim to know that their theory is true. They can only report that they feel helpless to believe otherwise, nor can they claim that their theory is highly probable. They can only acknowledge the inner compulsion that forbids them to doubt that it is highly probable. Some advocates of determinism evidently sense this epistemological dilemma and have sought to escape it by asserting that although they are determined to believe what they believe, the fact of determining them is logic. But by what means do they know this? Their beliefs are no more subject to their control than a lunatic's beliefs. They and the lunatic are equally the pawn of deterministic forces, according to them, but are both incapable of judging their judgments. Here is a rather interesting note. One of the defining characteristics of psychosis is loss of volitional control over rational judgment. But according to determinism, that is man's normal metaphysical state. There is no escape from determinism's epistemological state. A mind that is not free to test and validate its conclusions, a mind whose judgment is not free, can have no way to tell the logical from the illogical, no way to ascertain that which compels and motivates it, no right to claim knowledge of any kind. Such a mind is disqualified for such appraisals by its very nature. The very concept of logic is only possible to a volitional consciousness. An automatic consciousness would have no need of it and could not ever conceive of it. The concepts of logic, thought, and knowledge are not applicable to machines. A machine does not reason. It performs the actions its builder sets it to perform, and those actions are the only actions that it can perform. If it is set to register that 2 plus 2 equals 4, it does so. If it is set to register that 2 plus 2 equals 5, it does so. It has no power to correct the orders and the information given. If self-correctors are built into it, it performs the prescribed actions of self-correction and no others. If the self-correctors are set incorrectly, it cannot correct itself. It cannot make any independent self-generated contribution to its performance. If man, who is clearly not set invariably to be right, and were merely a super complex machine engineered by his heredity and operated by his environment, pushed, pulled, shaped, and molded by his genes and his toilet training, his parental upbringing, and his cultural history, then no premise reached by him could claim objectivity or truth, including the premise that man is merely a machine. So he's finishing by saying, it takes free will to come to the conclusion that man is purely a machine. And therein lies the contradiction. So guys, I'm out of recording time here. I just want to leave that with you. I hope it resonated with you. I've got more coming in on this subject. I hope today's show added some value. Please, please share this show so we can get it out there to people. We can help bring this information out. It's needed in this time, I feel. If you like the work that I do, subscribe to this YouTube channel. Follow me on Podbean. Follow me on iTunes. Get this show out as far and wide as we can. And I will have more amazing content and guests coming up your way here on Truth Warrior. Thanks for tuning in. I hope you have a great day. Go and use your free will to make good choices for you and everybody around you. Thanks for tuning in, guys. I'll catch you back here on Truth Warrior next time. Cheers.